Welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Bookshop Podcast. I'm Mandy Jackson Beverly. Join me as I chat with guests who specialize in topics dear to my heart, the humanities and our environment. Cooper Hefner is an American businessman, teacher, author, activist, and reservist in the United States Air Force. He has worked as the Chief Creative Officer and Chief of Global Partnerships at Playboy Enterprises, a company founded by his father, Hugh Hefner. In July 2020, Cooper announced he was launching an exploratory campaign to run as a Democrat for the California Senate in the state's 30th district. Hi, Cooper, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Lovely to have you here. I've been looking forward to chatting. What was the impetus behind joining the United States Air Force, and how has this changed your life perspective?
Well, for as long as I can recall, I have had a desire to serve, and I have always been a believer that service to country is important. It provides a shared purpose with individuals of all backgrounds. It also has many meaningful lessons as a young man or woman learning how to manage and perform both trivial as well as complex tasks in stressful environments, to how to perform and problem solve with people who think differently than you, have different life experiences than you. From my particular point of view, these are valuable tools you take throughout your life. And while I had been exposed to professional pursuits prior, and many of the airmen I was serving with were younger than I was while going through BMT, which is basic military training. That's the precursor, essentially taking you from civilian life and going through the motions very early on to make you and transform you into an airman at Lackland Air Force Base. The experience was one I won't forget, and I'm proud to be a member of the United States Air Force Reserve today. I will say that while the armed services provides tremendous opportunities for those who enlist, there are many other methods of community service involvement, and those two provide terrific lessons in life that I believe are additive and beneficial to the development of a person's character.
And we'll talk more about community service a little later. But for now, I'd like to talk about a 2018 Playboy magazine article titled, "In That Season of Turmoil and Change, A Bright Light, The Story of Hef, Jesse Jackson, and MLK." Reverend Jesse L. Jackson Sr. wrote, and I quote, "Amid the unrest of the 1960s, Hef risked everything to take a stand for civil rights, shining a light on issues that are just as urgent today," end of quote. In the 60s, Playboy was the social media of today. It had a far-reaching audience. Your father hired black writers such as Alex Haley when getting a writing gig at a magazine was difficult for black writers. At what age were you aware of your father's work with the civil rights movement, and did he speak of the importance of social justice with you and your siblings?
Jesse Jackson is someone I hold so near and dear to my heart. He is a family friend. He actually, the last time I saw him, we were honoring my father shortly after he passed. We had a memorial in Chicago, and he was one of the speakers and shared such beautiful words at such a difficult time, which one knows he is so great at, and comforts at some extraordinarily low moments. But it was particularly special. And I really appreciate you sharing that quote, because that relationship between and the friendship between him and my father goes decades. You have to understand that there is this preconceived notion that growing up at the mansion disconnected me from the way the world was by some. And in many respects, that is true, but I don't think in the way that most people believe it to be true. Much of this world is separated. And when I say this world, I mean just the social construct of our everyday is separated by race, gender, sexual orientation, religious affiliation, wealth and poverty, political party, and by so much more. That just was not present in our home. And you asked at what point did I recognize my father or the company's civil rights work within the civil rights movement. In truth, it was always there. I didn't notice it as something odd until I left home. And odd meaning that I did not recognize that there was a world that would still criticize people for racial differences or believe that they should not intermingle. And of course, I grew up at a much later time where that was not as pervasive and in one's face as an individual growing up in the early 20th century or even through the civil rights movement. But certainly, we are still struggling with so much of the challenges that the generations before us have wrestled with. And in truth, I'm extraordinarily grateful to have been raised in a home where we weren't taught to see those differences as qualities that should separate us. That in truth isn't just a testament to my mom and dad, but generations of work. My father often spoke about how his parents, my grandparents, were anti-segregationists. And these are people who were raised at the end of the 19th century or early 20th century. So that was significant. My grandmother was born in November of 1895. So the point here is that generations of teaching allow for people to either lean into bigotry and hate or compassion and love. And I was lucky to be in an environment at a relatively young age and for as long as I can remember where I was exposed to that love.
It's endearing hearing about the maternal trait of your grandmother's, her commitment to civil rights and social justice, seeping through to your father and then to you. People can be quick to view others, especially celebrities and people in the limelight, as one-dimensional. In other words, they don't see all the other traits that are multi-layered within an individual's personality.
Mm-hmm.
And Hugh Hefner is a really good example of this, because most people, when they think of him, think of Playboy. I wonder how many people consider the courage it took for him to stand up and do and say what he believed in during that time of the 60s regarding civil rights and social justice.
Yes, I do sit in that with such pride and also recognize that we all stand on the shoulders of the individuals who came before us. And I am grateful that the world is more compassionate and more open-minded because of the fight of good people like Jesse Jackson and my father and others. And I can't tell you, there's such humility and joy knowing that I have a parent who did that.
And your mother is also wonderful too.
Yes, she is a wonderful woman.
In July 2020, you announced you were launching an exploratory campaign to run as a Democrat for the California Senate in the state's 30th district, including Los Angeles County. On November 30, 2020, you announced your decision to suspend the campaign due to an immediate service obligation with the United States Air Force. What are your plans for your political future?
Well, I never had an ambition to be a politician. I have always had a desire to do good. That quality of public service, while yes, it materialized as a state Senate campaign to serve California's 30th district last year, is certainly more of a lifelong pursuit than anything else. The intrinsic motivation which guided that campaign is very much what led me to serve in the Air Force, and it has existed in most facets of both my personal and professional life, whether I'm engaged in public service or in the private sector. The goal continues to be just that, do good. And that will live in me, whether, as I shared, that is what is guiding an exploratory as well as a state Senate campaign or anything else I do.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Well, thank you.
You've spoken many times about service to the community and country. I'd like to think everyone wants to help others. However, sadly, that is not the case. One thought is to include community service into all school curriculums, beginning in the elementary school system. But some view mandatory community service as competing with academics. What are your thoughts on introducing some kind of junior Peace Corps program into the school system that is based in the local community?
My view is part of the collective goal in teaching the next generation of children is both to provide them with the tools needed in order to find success in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that happen with a focus on academics and what lessons can be learned in the class. Also to them why it is valuable to engage in community service, to share with them that a worthwhile pursuit in life is being an active member of their community. I think it's extraordinarily narrow-minded to assume that the only place children and adults can learn is inside a traditional classroom. Community service provides one of those other outlets, as you've identified. And from my perspective, your suggestion is one that should be discussed in a version welcomed, given the fact that, like you, I too see community services a quality that should be part of all schools' teaching curriculums. I do not in any way, shape, or form see it as competitive with a traditional curriculum. I think it truly is and should be a part of any well-rounded education.
Yes, and I'd add that I think the more we try to separate it, education and community service, the more of a barrier we put up there, and that's not good for anyone.
Yes.
I do believe the younger we introduce children to community service, it's easier for them to grasp and to enjoy. For example, if you were to take a classroom of kindergarten children into an elderly people's home and they each gave the residents a flower, the joy that giving that flower gives to the elderly person and the joy it gives to the child is, it just doesn't go away. It's such a great memory. And I really believe that the younger you teach children this and that they get to experience this feeling of joy from giving, it's almost like chocolate. You just need more. You just want more.
I think that is absolutely true.
And what is one way you'd like to see community service playing out on a community level, on an adult level? And I'm not talking financial donations, but rather a hands-on service to others.
Well, I'll give you two versions that I experienced, which were very different, but both extraordinarily rewarding in their own ways for me personally. And this takes me back to my adolescent years. The first, I attended a middle school that had a community service program, which took students out of their classrooms. We were bused to lower-income public schools in LAUSD and spent the day mentoring children who were several years younger than us. Understand that many of the children I went to school with were from affluent families, helping these children with their studies, attempting to work through if they were stuck on a particular problem and getting to know them, sometimes even hearing about their struggles both within the classroom and out. It humanizes our shared experience having moments like these, especially at a young age, which was the comment that you had made before. They're important and necessary in the development from my particular point of view if we want our children to become well-rounded and thoughtful adults. Another example, I went to a high school which emphasized environmental science and technology and outdoor education. And when I was a student, there were mandatory backpacking trips that took us outside of the classroom. I recall one trip where we learned about tide pools in California. Another trip to Yosemite allowed us an opportunity to hear from teachers that in regards to my own life experiences, it was my first time listening to adults who were educators talk about the changing weather and how humanity was contributing to that change and how this could be a change in how much rain a place usually gets a year, or could be a change in a particular location usual to one temperature of the month or season. And it was my first introduction to climate change. And the point being here is there are many ways community service can and should play out at a local level. And I think that introducing that at a young age and having that materialize later on in life is important. And while financial contributions and capital engagement donations are important, there are many other valuable ways to help that benefit your community and surroundings as well as benefit you. schools can and should do it, and people should too.
In the same vein, it's important we find ways to introduce children from inner city schools to our national parks and beaches. It's not until we actually see the beauty that we want to protect. We understand that everything is connected and the importance we play in making change.
I would also piggyback on that and comment on the fact that we're still in an environment that unfortunately is creating a crisis, which has become too infrequently, I think, in this day and age, that we have significant crises that should be tackled collectively, but the folks who are participating and leading at a federal and state and local level oftentimes seem to politicize and communicate ineffectively. And I hear what you're saying and agree that there is an education process that should happen in lower income areas. However, this is not solely a, I think, high income, low income conversation. I have been, and I'm sure you have, in plenty of circles with people who are extraordinarily well off, who do not acknowledge climate change as being a crisis that needs to be a focus. And I see this as certainly one of the great challenges, potentially the greatest of our lifetime. I think the immediate is COVID, but certainly having a greater conversation and relying and understanding the science and actually taking steps and action to mitigate what we've already done is necessary. But I agree with the sensibility of educating people. However, I don't think that that is solely a wealthy versus lower income challenge. It really is a political conversation in nature because of folks who have too frequently tried to make a topic something that should be beneficial to their own pursuit rather than finding a way to say this is a collective problem that we need to make sure that we focus on together.
And I'll add that it's a lot easier when you have money to go and see the beautiful parts of the world, but it's a little different when you're living on a welfare check in the projects. And this topic brings me on to the next question. The California dream once consisted of owning your own home. With real estate prices skyrocketing around the country, this is no longer a reality. You've spoken on wanting to push for zoning laws that facilitate the new construction of smart, environmentally friendly housing for home buyers and renters. How can we make this a reality, and the sooner the better?
Well, this is a multidimensional problem that requires greater discussion and ingenuity. Firstly, there is a homelessness crisis that is progressively getting worse. We simultaneously have an affordable housing crisis facing the state of California. But first, let's discuss the homeless issue. About 71% of the homeless population in California is living unsheltered. That's 71%, which to me is absolutely horrifying. We need three things here. The first, a significant investment in eradicating homelessness by building permanent low-cost housing. The entire infrastructure and focus on temporary shelters doesn't provide a long-term solution to the ongoing problem. City and the states of California need to reimagine their approach. And in truth, there are some efforts to do that. To put it plainly, we should look at this crisis through a lens of greater compassion. From my particular point of view, local and state municipalities must better engage in providing quality mental health services to a company. That's the second piece, which is as critical as the first. While there are a number of individuals and families that find themselves in unfortunate situations leading to homelessness because they fall on hard times, and we have to be mindful of them as well, there are a significantly higher number of individuals struggling who need health services that just aren't provided. And I believe it was the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development that completed an assessment and found that nearly 565,000 people were homeless on any given night throughout the entire country. And of that group, 25% suffered from serious mental illness. 45% had some form of mental illness. So again, that takes us to 70% of the total population. We're doing ourselves a disservice if we're ignoring these types of data points. We have to destigmatize mental health in the process of solving this problem. And in that, we can deliver a real solution that lasts. It is possible to do, but I do believe often our uncomfort causes us to make matters worse. That has to stop. This effort will save lives while improving the outlook for people who may feel hopeless and lost. I just truly do believe we have to emphasize in humanity. It isn't all right to see a person sleeping on the street, drive past them, feel sad, and go on with our lives. This is too routine for my wife and I and others who live in California. And we do focus on, after passing that person, coming up with solutions about how we can effectively solve the problem. And we can. We just need to collectively take action. The other part of this, which you mentioned and called the California dream, is a unique problem. There is clearly an imbalance between supply and demand within the state with housing. We're seeing the result of strong economic growth, creating hundreds of thousands of new jobs, which increases demand for housing, and the insufficient construction of new housing units to provide enough supply to meet the demand. I think there are a few solutions to this. However, I don't believe every problem that we face should be solved by the government. Oftentimes, problems are made worse by government intervention. In truth, I think this will lead a lot of remarkably talented people moving out of California, the nature of not having the ability to have a certain quality of life that one would have been able to have maybe 15, 20, 30 years ago. And as unfortunate as that is, that's already happening and has happened. There are methods that should be looked at to fixing this. Creating an affordable housing trust is one option. Offer incentives and tax breaks, you had mentioned, which when we had launched our exploratory campaign, we had really focused and emphasized rewriting zoning laws and developing rules that help the situation from becoming worse. But I think the most promising opportunity to solve this won't come from any one solution or a quick fix. Mm-hmm. It will come from a long partnership between public servants, developers, and large organizations working to deliver solutions. One method I think should be a focus is revitalizing neighborhoods. There are great neighborhoods in California and in Los Angeles County that just aren't as safe as they should be. And investing in community and public safety is a good place to start.
And of course, we can't talk about the homeless situation without acknowledging the hunger situation, because there's so many children go hungry in this country every day. While I was listening to you speak about community, I remembered an Instagram post you posted just before the holidays, I think it was. You wrote that if anyone didn't have food to put on the table, to direct message you, because you and Scarlett wanted to help them out and make sure they had food. While I was reading through the comments of this post, I noticed that you kind of started a snowball effect, because there are other people saying, hey, I was thinking about doing this, and now you've motivated me to do it. If we see someone else helping another, it encourages us to want to do the same.
I agree. It was our pleasure, and we're very fortunate. And I also have a belief that kindness is contagious.
That right there is your campaign slogan, Cooper.
Well, it's true. I mean, in the sense of, you know, we're here for, and I'm talking about in life, we're here for a pretty short period of time. And, you know, if you're fortunate enough to be in a position to help people, you have an obligation to, in my view. So we're lucky that we actually get joy from doing those things. And I appreciate you saying the kind words that you did. But truth be told, I think I got more joy out of it than any gift that we provided.
You are a member of the Pacific Council on International Policy. Can you tell us about the organization and what drew you to join them?
I was invited to join the Pacific Council on International Policy by John Emerson. John is a dear friend who is an American diplomat. John served as the United States ambassador to Germany from 2013 to 2017, I believe, under President Obama. And John and I share a lot of the same passions and values. He had told me that the Pacific Council on International Policy was a well-regarded membership based organization that was dedicated to global engagement with an emphasis on foreign relations and policy. And I engaged at his request. And that was really the primary motivation. It's a community of working professionals in Los Angeles and California who are working to deliver solutions on global issues, discourse and policy. And I have so far found engaging in the organization to be remarkably rewarding.
And you're also a member of the board of directors of Children of the Night, a privately funded nonprofit organization established in 1979. Can you share with us the mission of this group and how and why you became involved? I am guessing that since you became a dad, any issues that bring hardship to children are issues that as parents we tend to gravitate toward. But I would love to hear about Children of the Night and what they do.
Yes, I've served as a director on the board of Children of the Night for nearly half a decade. The organization is a well-regarded local NGO that since 1979 has operated a variety of programs for America's child sex trafficking victims, including a nationwide hotline, a drop-in center, various street programs throughout the Western United States, as well as a shelter located in Van Nuys, California, where more than 3,000 children have lived and received comprehensive case management and on-site schooling. Dr. Lois Lee, who is the president and founder of Children of the Night, is someone I have known for quite some time. Several years ago, she and leadership were looking to diversify their board, and I joined as a director as part of that effort. To your comment about having a daughter and thinking about children who are struggling in day-to-day life, it does hurt more. And that pain and seeing and thinking about any child unnecessarily suffering or subjected to an environment that is abusive or unhealthy is a really horrifying note. So my particular point of view is if there is a way to contribute your time or skills and you have the ability to help in that effort, you should. And this is really a wonderful organization that does that. And I'm grateful to be affiliated.
Now, I live in Ventura County, one of the many counties in California facing severe drought with no end in the foreseeable future. Drought is a worldwide problem, and this brings up two issues, environment and immigration. At the beginning of episode 20 of my podcast, I speak about immigration. Specifically, I talk about open borders. And obviously, there have to be rules and regulations when you have open borders. But I'd really appreciate your thoughts on immigration.
So to your first comment regarding the drought, last year was the driest year in California history since measurements began in the mid-19th century. Some scientists have even shared that I believe in 2013, it may have been the driest year for over 400 years. We have to understand that this is part of our lives living in California. However, the choices we make will cause greater suffering for our cities, our communities, for wildlife, or will alleviate the pain caused. Steps should be taken by local and state government to encourage people to cut down on personal water usage during periods of extraordinary drought. Simple things like checking your faucets and pipes for leaks, running the dishwasher only when it's full, take quicker showers. While it's hard to sometimes see oneself in the bigger picture, this does save water and energy and have a positive impact. So we can all do a lot to lessen the negative impact of this issue. And as I shared before, that is just a component of living and calling California home. In regards to your immigration question, there is proof in the pudding that immigration, without question, allows for us to build a more dynamic economy. And from my particular point of view, live in a much richer and more rewarding society. Immigration increases economic growth. It provides skilled workers such as doctors, teachers, and nurses. Immigrants often fill job vacancies, working extraordinarily hard doing unpopular work. We also see immigrant entrepreneurs starting businesses, innovating industry. I am a major proponent of supporting people coming to the United States to work, to make an honest living, and to better their lives. I, at a fundamental level, understand that it is who we are. With that being said, establishing rule of law at the border is essential to our national security. And open border would allow for the passing through of, as you had noted, trying to figure out how to manage lawful with inviting and compassion. We do know that an open border would allow for the passing through of illegal weapons, people, incentivize unlawful trade and travel. I think that, similar to climate change, unfortunately, this is another topic that has become so polarized that it becomes hard for us to really deconstruct. And I sit in the camp of believing that we should and can celebrate immigrant communities and ensure there are opportunities for those wanting to come here, who want to improve their lives, and if they have loved ones and families, their loved ones' lives, while recognizing the need to have a secure border.
I really like the phrase you use, celebrating immigrant communities. Whenever I hear someone say, oh, you know, they shouldn't be allowing so many immigrants into the country, or it's too easy to become an American citizen, as an American citizen who is an immigrant, I can attest to the fact that it is not easy. One has to undergo a lot of tests, and it's expensive to become a citizen. Yeah, immigration is something that I could go on about forever, so I guess I need to be quiet.
I too could have a very long conversation about it and remain extraordinarily passionate about making sure that people understand who we were, so that they can better understand who we are and who we should be tomorrow. There is no one here who is not an immigrant outside of people who were stolen from Africa or the Native American communities and families and tribes that were here before European imperialists landed on the shores. And we are still wrestling with the Achilles heel of our past. And unfortunately, like climate change, there are too many people who are painting the picture like they want to serve, engaging in government, and really making important topics and problems more sensational than they should be. And that allows for them to take advantage of them to their own benefit, which I truly do believe is one of the reasons why in the recent past, immigration has become a topic that is extraordinarily difficult for certain members of the same family to converse about, which should not be the case at all.
Let's talk about small businesses. Every week, I interview independent bookshop owners and listen to the unique ways they are staying afloat during COVID. I recently interviewed Allison Hill, CEO of the American Booksellers Association, and Allison explained that when we buy from a business such as Amazon, our local communities miss out on a percentage of the tax dollars from that sale going back into their communities. Now, a majority of people aren't aware of this. It just doesn't cross their minds. But if we want our communities to be sustainable, we need to purchase as much as we can locally. Your thoughts?
I think there's a lot of truth to your statement. While large businesses do have qualities to them that are positive, for instance, large scale employment opportunities, et cetera, but those also are accompanied by a whole host of challenges. Supporting local business is extraordinarily important, whether we're talking about a local bookstore, a coffee shop, a farmer's market. Buying at smaller businesses is critical to supporting and building local economies. My wife and I work to support local businesses when we can, and we certainly did this through the pandemic. We also enjoy the personal quality of it, learning about who the people are who started the business, why they did it. We have both found that makes the food you're consuming or the book you're enjoying or the coffee you're drinking all the better.
And isn't it fun listening to the stories of the people who own these small independent stores? And speaking of stories, what is one book you'd like to see more people reading?
My wife and I have started an at-home book club with two members, just her and I. And we are currently reading Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. It's brilliant, fantastically written. I don't know if you've read it, but...
Talking to Strangers is one of Gladwell's books I have not read. I've heard him speak, read every other one of his books, but I have not read that one. So it's definitely on my to-be-read list.
In short, it sets out to elaborate on how we might better understand and accurately judge people's true intentions rather than being blinded because of self-projection or because of a desire to put our full faith in truth. It's a great read, and if nothing else, will make you critically think. And I would suggest that to anyone who is listening, who is looking for an interesting read. And Mandy, as you can attest to, all of Malcolm's books are thoughtful and remarkably written. So we're actually planning on diving into a few others. We're enjoying that book.
Cooper, I have thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you, and thank you and Scarlett for all you do to help our communities. And I look forward to having you on the show anytime.
Oh, thank you, Mandy. It was wonderful talking to you too.